From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, coming up, New York Attorney General Letitia James filed suit earlier this month against major companies over PFAS, so-called forever chemicals. We check in with Rob Hayes, Senior Director of Clean Water at Environmental Advocates New York. Talk to him about the suit and the chemicals. It's coming up in the second half of the program. And also coming up, I talked to Carter Walker of Vote Beat about the multiple avenues the Trump administration is pursuing to get the country on board with its vision for U.S. elections. A bunch of states led by Democrats are suing the administration, saying it's making emergency funding contingent on their election policies. I talked to Carter Walker coming up in just a moment. Also, young people from Sullivan County are learning how to be emergency responders at the Youth Fire Academy. We have that story for you as well. We're going to start off right now with news from Albany that might impact you because, starting this January, New Yorkers will need to prove that they're over 18 years old before continuing to scroll through their social media feeds. Governor Hochul says that's the result of new law designed to protect children from social media addiction. Apps won't be able to send notifications to minors between midnight and 6 a.m., and children will have only basic feeds.
So under 18, your feed can only include accounts that you follow, that you choose, not sitting there as just a victim of this all bombardment, that you actually will have a choice of what you see.
It's New York Governor Kathy Hochul. State Attorney General Letitia James says that these rules will make social media safer for kids and protect their mental health.
This law does not ban young people from social media, and it does not restrict what they can say or see. This is not a question of privacy. This is a question about content.
When it comes time to prove their age, people can do so with a government-issued ID, but can also use a face scan, credit card, email address, or phone number. Tech companies didn't comment on the unfolding regulations, which take effect in late January. Well, students from across Sullivan County went to a different kind of school recently, a school where police, firefighters, and paramedics were the teachers. 23 high schoolers, all 14 to 16 years old, spent the week with first responders at the county's third annual Emergency Services Youth Academy. WAMC's Alias Guerra has more.
We did fire stuff, I think, the other day with that stuff. Yesterday we did the canine stuff, like bombs, with the bomb squad. They showed us the robot that they bring to get the bomb and bring it back, and they explode it themselves the way that they want to and not how they, how the people who set the bombs want to. And we got to meet the canine dog unit, and that was super fun.
That was Alyssa McLeod, who said her father is second assistant chief at the Jeffersonville Fire Department. She plans to join him when she turns 16. Jake Zenas says cadets there can start at 16 years old and can learn a lot.
They go to calls. They watch the rest of the firefighters work. There are classes that they can also take. There's in-house training that they can take. As long as they show up to drills, work nights, and stuff like that, firefighters more than happy to show them anything they want to know.
James Sherwood, 15 years old, is already a cadet at the Livingston Manor Fire Department. He's not old enough to go out on calls, but he still helps out.
But it's still a lot of fun. We get to sit there. We can clean the rigs. We get to go out on drill.
He said cadets even go to live fire sometimes as long as they stay at a safe distance.
Well, like this one drill that we went on, we were doing a controlled burn of a condemned house, and we were just, of course, we aren't allowed to do anything, so we had to watch from a safe distance, but we were still able to sit there and gain the experience of, like, watching how some things are handled.
Other students, like Makai Squire, said he's been looking for cadet programs across the Catskills and Hudson Valley.
What do you like the idea of being a firefighter?
Saving people. Yeah. Saving people, I like, and putting out fires, because something not everybody wants to do because it's a dangerous job.
Young people who want to join emergency services couldn't be doing so at a better time. John D'Alessandro with the Fire Association of the State of New York says that 80% to 85% of fire and emergency response in New York State is done by volunteers. And he said it's getting harder to recruit young people.
In the early 2000s, there were about 120,000 volunteers across the state. We estimate that we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 today. Sort of, you know, steady decline in the number of volunteers around the state.
The problem is acute in rural areas of New York. Tony Carlucci is the captain of Bethel Emergency Medical Services. He works there full time, but says the rest of Bethel EMS is all volunteer. Carlucci said it's even harder for EMS to recruit because people are always getting sick, which leads to burnout for volunteers.
It's a lot for a volunteer to do. Between responding from your house, getting your ambulance, and meeting on scene, assessing the patient, putting them in the ambulance, and then transporting whether to Harris or Orange, and then you have the offload time, and then you got to come back, a call could be 2 or 3 hours long, depending on where you're going.
Carlucci said they also struggle with retention, especially as more people move into the area. D'Alessandro said incentives like tax credits for volunteers have not increased in 2 decades. Recent state legislation would raise the tax credits for volunteer firefighters and ambulance crews from $200 to $800 and awaits the governor's decision. For Alyssa McLeod, being a firefighter is something of a calling.
They just help out, and my dad does it. He risks his life. He risks his life like every single time he goes on a call. And I just want to do it.
You're not worried about the danger at all?
I am, but it's also about helping other people.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. Well, with multiple stories in the news right now about the Trump administration's efforts to change how elections are run in the United States, from pushing the Save America Act in Congress to appealing its ban on mail ballots to the Supreme Court in a midterm election year, well, I figured it's time to talk to Carter Walker, which I did earlier today. Carter Walker, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Thanks for having me.
So there's been some developments since we talked about President Trump's executive order about mail voting. Do you want to tell people what's been happening the last couple of weeks?
Yeah. So if you'll recall, in the spring, in April, the president had issued an executive order on mail ballots. And what it was looking to do was, one of the primary things was have states generate a list of the people who are going to be voting by mail in their state. And then send that list to the United States Postal Service, and the Postal Service would only provide the mail ballots, actually mail them out and return them from people on that state's approved list. Now, the states had sued, saying, you know, that's a step over the line legally into our authority to conduct elections, and a judge had agreed with them and said that, yeah, you know what, that's under the state's purview, I'm going to block that. So what happened recently is the administration, of course, didn't like that. They asked the appeals court in the federal jurisdiction where that ruling was to intervene. The appeals court declined to intervene. So now they're taking it to the Supreme Court, hoping to still get that executive order implemented ahead of the fall election.
Right. And there's nowhere else to go above the Supreme Court. That's why we call it the Supreme Court. But because the administration is looking to get their way on this before November, is that likely to happen, that we would hear from the Supreme Court? Are they asking in a way that would expedite this?
Well, of course, that's what the administration would like, is to get it implemented before then. But it's always hard to know exactly what the Supreme Court will do. Although there's an important legal principle when it comes to election law. It's called the Purcell principle. And basically that's, you know, quite logical. You might already think of it, is that courts don't want to change the rules of an election close to an election unless absolutely necessary. So that's the first hurdle the administration will have to get past, is convincing the court that it is absolutely necessary to make this change right now, even though, you know, we're within 100 days of the election now.
Have you seen anything from this court in recent years that would indicate that they might overlook that Purcell concept?
I think there was a lot of court decisions around the 2020 election not just in the Supreme Court level, but in the state courts too, that were coming late in the cycle or during the period of the election or when ballots are being counted. So, you know, it's not unheard of that these kind of things happen, but I think a lot of courts took away from the 2020 election cycle, even more so that they wanted to avoid doing that kind of thing.
Well, whatever the Supreme Court does or doesn't do on this, when it does or doesn't happen, I definitely want to talk to you again about it because I know you've been watching it and we've been talking about it. So thank you so much for that update. Now, another thing kind of along these lines is it really seems that President Trump is trying to get his way with elections and especially is looking for, you know, the SAVE Act to be passed. So trying to get his way with the House. He's trying to get his way with the Senate right now. But also, it seems like the administration is trying to get its way with various states, and the states are suing because they're saying that the Trump administration is withholding grant funds in order to get its way with how elections are being run in those states. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the overarching point you're making is spot on. The president has been trying to get his preferred election policies adopted either by the states or by Congress in any way he can. You know, he's withholding his signature on bills to get the SAVE Act passed. He's trying to get them to pass versions of it through a budget bill process. And then, of course, he's got all these other efforts that his administration is undertaking in the courts, whether it's the Department of Justice trying to get voter rolls from the states, his executive orders that are being fought in the courts by these states, or this new suit that you're talking about. And, you know, this is a new one from just last week. We've seen the administration over the past 2 years say various things. You know, in there was some suggestion of this in the incident that happened with the shooting in Minneapolis with ICE earlier this year, that they were trying to leverage some things there to get them to comply with the Department of Justice's requests for voter rolls. But now the states here, they're suing the administration, saying the administration is making explicit demands that that the states have to go along with some of the policies the administration is pushing on elections, or they're not going to be given some of the Federal Emergency Management Act grant funds that have been allocated to the states. And obviously the states are not happy with that, and they want the administration to release those funds, and now they're taking them to court to do so.
I think the quote that stands out to me the most in this article, you just put up an article about this for VoteBeat just 4 days ago, and the one thing that really leapt out to me was this line. In a statement, a spokesperson for FEMA said it was nothing new that these Democratic leaders, quote, oppose common sense measures, end quote, on election security. And it just struck me as, I don't know, almost novel that like a FEMA representative, Federal Emergency Management representative, would be just criticizing, you know, how elections are run in various states in what sounds to be a very political way. Does election security fall under FEMA because of DHS, or what's going on there?
No, well, I mean, election security is considered a national security issue. I think that was established at the tail end of the Obama administration after the Russian interference in the 2016 election. So I do believe that falls under the Department of Homeland Security. But yeah, the specific grants at issue here that FEMA has control over, they're not election related. I suppose they might touch on elections because they're related to monitoring and responding to terrorist activities. And of course, you know, unfortunately, a terrorist activity could take place, I suppose, that, you know, some kind of elections infrastructure. But they're not like directly tied. So it does make it a little bit unusual. You know, in the states, I think I didn't get a specific response to them, to that quote from FEMA. But I think the states are going to oppose in court the idea that these are common sense measures. One of the things that the administration is asking for is for them to use this program that the Department of Homeland Security has set up that's supposed to help check voter rolls for citizenship eligibility. But states and in fact, even courts have been finding that there's problems with that database, that it's creating false positives and saying, you know, some citizens who are eligible to vote are not eligible to vote. So I think they would push back on that idea that it's common sense that we should be using these kind of things.
Yeah, and common sense is like a refrain here. It seems like the administration's position is to say, why wouldn't you want to check to make sure that people aren't voting illegally, which does sound, you know, like it makes sense. But you're saying when they actually look at this specific database, what you're telling me is it is prone to preventing people who should be able to vote from voting.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I'll say I've spoke with a lot of election officials, state and local, and I've never heard any of them, you know, Republican or Democrat, say, yeah, we don't want to check for non-citizens on our voter rolls. All of them are in favor of doing that kind of thing and making sure non-citizens can't get on the voter rolls. The refrain you hear most commonly from Democratic election officials, but also from Republican election officials, and many of them are nonpartisan even, what they say is we got to make sure we're balancing that priority with the priority of not disenfranchising anyone who may be eligible, because the United States, just given the nature of the fact that, you know, we're a federalized country where we have basically 50 little countries that come together to form one country, we don't have like a very comprehensive database of our citizenship. Many countries in Europe, they do have that kind of thing, but since we don't, that's what makes doing these checks somewhat difficult. And election officials say, we want to get non-citizens off the rolls and make sure only eligible people are voting, but we don't want to take those measures too far where we actually end up disenfranchising more people than we are removing from the rolls who shouldn't be there.
You know, Carter, I know this is on the side, and I don't know if there's anything you've really been reporting on, but it's also bringing to mind, as we just talk about this administration's approach to elections in America in a big election year, the fact that over the last week or so, it sounds like the Election Assistance Commission doesn't really have any commissioners anymore. But that's just popping into my mind, because as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, there is this real question of to what degree do local entities, specifically, you know, states, but also county boards of elections, they're the ones that oversee how elections are run. I'm wondering if county and state election officials, you know, are looking for guidance and are looking for help from the federal government. But as you say, this particular type of help isn't what they're looking for. So I'm thinking in my mind, I'm thinking like, where do things need to be done to coordinate those 50 different entities? And what might those states be looking for? And then it popped in my mind, oh, yeah, there's this Election Assistance Commission. You know, that's the sort of thing that you think would help with that. Are you aware of this commission? Is that anything that you've been keeping an eye on? And if not, we don't even have to talk about it.
Yeah, no, I can talk about that. My colleague Jessica Huseman, she has done some reporting on that the situation at the EAC recently, which you guys can find at vote.org. But one of the main things the EAC provides to states is it sets kind of a uniform standard for what our voting equipment should look like. Now, that standard states don't have to adopt, but most of them do, and the standards are already out right now. So the turmoil at the EAC, it's not clear, at least to me right now, exactly what the effect will be on states and counties. But more to your overall point of the federal government changing how they're monitoring or supporting local elections, you know, they have made a lot of changes to that. And really, I think one of the big ones was last year, when they sort of dismantled the cybersecurity and infrastructure, I forget the other part of the acronym, it's CISA, S-I-C-I-S-A. And what was important about that organization was it was providing, like, basically intelligence on threats, you know, whether that's, like, terroristic threats or cybersecurity threats to county and state election officials so that they had that information. Obviously, you know, our state governments, they don't have CIA and FBI and, you know, NSA type agencies. So they rely on the federal government for that type of intelligence information. And I heard from a lot of election officials at the time when that went away, that they were worried about that loss, worried about being able to coordinate information across state lines so that they could know about threats ahead of time. So I think that's the thing that they're really missing from the federal government and wanting to see more of.
Anything in your reporting on this story indicate how this suit might fare in court?
No, not yet. I think that it's a little too early to know at this point. It was only filed last week, and we still got to see a response from the Department of Homeland Security. So I imagine, though, that both the states and the federal government are going to want this one to move quickly. Obviously, the states want that security funding back, and the department, of course, wants these priorities in place before the midterm.
And yes, it is a midterm election year. I thank you again so much for talking to us. We're talking to Carter Walker with VoteBeat, and these stories are up now at votebeat.org. Carter, thank you once again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Earlier this month, New York State Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit against major manufacturing companies like 3M and DuPont for their use of PFAS chemicals, in their products. Exposure to these chemicals comes with an increased risk of developing cancer and other health complications. Radio Catskill reporter Rebecca Hendricks spoke with Rob Hayes, Senior Director of Clean Water and Environmental Advocates New York, to learn more about this lawsuit and the chemicals in question.
Welcome to Radio Catskill, Rob.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So for people that are not familiar, can you tell us, what are PFAS chemicals?
PFAS are also known as forever chemicals, and that's because they can persist for thousands of years when they enter our environment. They're very difficult to break down, and they have been linked to a long list of toxic health effects, from kidney cancer to thyroid disease to preeclampsia. I mean, the list goes on and on. The more that we learn about these chemicals, the more dangerous that we realize they are. And these are chemicals that big chemical corporations like 3M and DuPont have been putting into products since the 1950s, products like firefighting foam and cookware and food packaging. And over those many decades, those products have contaminated our environment, our water, our soil, our air, as these companies continue to make huge, huge profits. And that's why we're so thrilled that the Attorney General has just brought a new lawsuit against these PFAS corporations to hold them accountable for the pollution they've caused.
So can you tell us more about the Attorney General's lawsuit? What specifically is her legal argument against these companies?
Attorney General Tish James is arguing that big chemical corporations like 3M and DuPont knew that PFAS were dangerous, that they were toxic and harmful to our health when they were putting them in these products decades ago. And yet they included them in these products anyway because they knew they could use them to make enormous profits. And so the Attorney General is arguing that this violates a whole host of laws in New York meant to protect consumers, and that these companies should be responsible for the damage they've caused to our environment and to human health. And so the Attorney General is seeking damages to help pay for water filtration and other remediation activities to make New York whole again and to make sure that polluters pay for the damage they've caused.
And how does this affect New York State specifically? Is this a nationwide issue, or is it particularly harmful here in our state?
You know, the PFAS crisis is a nationwide crisis, but New York was one of the first states to really grapple with this issue. We had some of the earliest detected PFAS contamination in the country. Many folks might remember the news stories about Hoosick Falls and Newburgh, New York. These were communities that detected exceedingly high levels of PFAS chemicals in their water, and where the communities are still dealing with the health repercussions of that almost a decade and over a decade later. You know, we know that PFAS kills and it harms human health. And that's why it's so essential that New York take action to hold PFAS polluters accountable and to pass funding and legislation to both clean up contamination that is present in our environment, but also to turn off the tap and stop future contamination from happening.
And it's a crucial part of this lawsuit that companies knew about these harmful effects, but still created the products anyway. How long have we known about the effects of PFAS chemicals?
Yeah, you know, the science on PFAS has really been evolving over the past several decades. And the more that we learn about these chemicals, the more dangerous that we realize they are. And we're coming to these realizations through independent scientists, through independent science that these companies have known for decades. And one of the scariest things out there right now is that these companies are still producing PFAS. They are still putting PFAS into cookware and dental floss, into paints, into many other products that New Yorkers use on an everyday basis, and yet is putting their health and their environment at risk. That's why one of the main pieces of legislation that Environmental Advocates New York has been pursuing in recent years has been to ban PFAS chemicals in consumer products where there are already PFAS-free alternatives on the market, so we can turn off the tap on toxic contamination and keep folks safe.
And let's talk a bit more about those points of exposure. What kinds of exposure put you at risk? Is it just ingestion, or is it being around these products?
You know, there can be a number of sources of exposure. The biggest source of exposure to PFAS is through drinking water. And that is why it is so essential that New York State establish stringent and health protective drinking water standards on PFAS, so folks can rest assured that their water utility is testing for these chemicals and filtering them out of the water if harmful levels are detected. On this issue, the governor has the ability to take a really great step in the fight against PFAS by signing a bill that the state legislature passed about a month ago that would codify very health protective drinking water standards on PFAS that the Trump administration is actually trying to roll back right now. That is the most important thing the governor can do right now to reduce folks' exposure to PFAS chemicals through their drinking water. But there are other sources of exposure as well. There are PFAS in beauty and cosmetic products. And when we put those on our skin, there can be potential dermal exposure and threats to human health that way. You know, the ubiquity of these chemicals means that almost every American has PFAS in their blood.
Here in Sullivan County, in a rural area, we have a lot of agriculture. How do PFAS chemicals affect farms?
One other major source of PFAS into our environment is through the use of contaminated sewage sludge on farms and other open space. Sewage sludge is produced through the wastewater treatment process. You know, the waste that goes from our toilets through the pipes down to a wastewater treatment plant. That wastewater treatment plant separates the solids from the waters. And that's solid ends up being sludge. The problem is that wastewater utilities are collecting waste, not just from our homes, but also from many industries as well, including industries that use and produce large amounts of PFAS. And so this solid, this contaminated sludge, ends up being a big source of PFAS into our environment. Many farmers will take that sludge from the wastewater treatment plants. They will spread it across their fields, and it poses real risk to our food supply that may then become contaminated with PFAS. Unfortunately, it is still perfectly legal to spread PFAS-contaminated sewage sludge in New York State, and that's why there's a bill in the state legislature that would put a moratorium on the spreading of sewage sludge in order to do more testing and provide support to farmers who might be dealing with this issue so that we can find a better way to dispose of this waste without putting our food supply at risk.
If these companies were to be found liable and potentially roll back their use of PFAS chemicals, would that have any effect on the amount of PFAS chemicals we see in wastewater?
Absolutely. You know, turning off the tap on PFAS means that there is going to be less contamination entering our environment. By removing PFAS from products, we remove PFAS from the waste stream, and that means less PFAS into our environment.
Thank you so much, Rob, for joining us on Radio Catskill today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Rob Hayes, the Senior Director of Clean Water at Environmental Advocates New York. You can find out more on this story on our website, wjffradio.org. In Liberty, I'm Rebecca Hendricks for Radio Catskill.
And thank you to Rebecca for that report. That's about it for the local edition tonight. Before we go, we do have some breaking news to update for you, because the Village of Liberty declared a local state of emergency this evening because of heavy rainfall causing flash flooding and road closures. Emergency crews are out working. Mayor Stoddard issued the emergency declaration at 5 p.m. Balsam Drive and Charles Street have been closed because of flooding. Motorists are urged to avoid the area and use alternate routes. Officials warn that additional road closures could occur as rain continues and as conditions change. Village officials urge residents to avoid driving through flooded roadways and remain alert for changing weather conditions. Remember, there's a flood watch in effect through tomorrow evening for Sullivan County and surrounding portions of central New York and northeast PA. We've probably had inches of rainfall already today.